National Security This Week, a weekly look at American national security issues. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, January 26th, and you've joined us for National Security This Week. We get together here on KYMN Radio every Wednesday at 9 a.m. to discuss national security, and we're joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us explore American national security. Last year, I'd hoped to host a number of shows on how important space has become for American national security, and today we're going to start a series of shows for the year 2022 that covers space, the Space Force, and how important space is for America's continued dominance in the military arena and for our economy. And I suspect you're really going to enjoy today's program. Our guest today is Professor David Burbach from the U.S. Naval War College. Professor David Burbach is Associate Professor of National Security Affairs and teaches the politics of U.S. foreign policy, space security, and international relations. His scholarly interests include civil-military relations, defense planning, and the relationship between international security and technology, particularly space and nuclear policy. Before joining the Naval War College faculty in 2007, he taught at the Army's School of Advanced Military Studies and also worked for several policy analysis and information technology organizations. Dr. Burbach earned a Bachelor of Arts in Government from Pomona College, then his Doctorate in Political Science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT. Dr. David Burbach, welcome to National Security This Week.
Good morning, John. Thank you for having me on today.
And it looks like on our Zoom picture here that we're sharing that you are at home. Is that right?
That is correct. I'm at my home in Providence, Rhode Island.
All right. That's a beautiful area. I know it well. I spent a year at the Naval War College in Newport, so I'm very familiar with Providence. So, Professor Burbach, I often start the show by trying to learn a little bit more about our guests, your background and whatnot. That said, you pursued a doctorate in political science from MIT. What drew you to study political science?
Sure, John. I'm happy to talk about that. I grew up as a Cold War kid, and I actually, in some ways, since we're talking about space today, it's returning to my interest because I, as a kid, I wanted to be an astronomer or study the planets. But my interest in technology back in the early 1980s led me to get interested in things like nuclear weapons, rockets, and missiles. You know, what could this stuff do? And then that led to being interested in, well, why do we have all them? When might we use these massively powerful weapons? And I got increasingly interested in the politics of science and technology, as well as the science itself. So I switched to the more prosaic answer is also when I got to college, I realized that I liked writing papers more than I liked doing my math homework. And at some point, it sunk in that that was a bit of a minus if I wanted to be an astrophysicist. So I actually switched to study political science and went to MIT because as you might expect for MIT, their political science department is particularly strong in science and technology. Has a very strong national security studies program. I decided to go in that direction. So spent the 1990s, mid to late 90s at MIT, and then about the last 15 years now, I have been in the unusual, somewhat hybrid position of being a government academic.
Yeah. And your specialty areas of study and teaching, especially at the Naval War College, what drew you to those specific topics, including space security?
Sure. I've done a couple of things, and to up a little bit with the end of the Cold War and then the focus on the war on terror, space was not a top flight issue for the military or for political science in general. I also developed a strong interest in understanding the politics of foreign policy. Why did we make the decisions we made to get into wars, to organize our military in certain ways, to buy the weapons we did, understanding how public opinion fit into all of that. And then especially since I began teaching for the military, focusing specifically on what we call civil-military relations. Mm-hmm. How in a democracy do we control and organize and relate to the military? Not just at the we don't want to have a military coup level. I mean, nobody wants that. but more specifically, how do we make sure that we do well while protecting the country while also living up to the sort of democratic norms, and political control of a professional military that we hope to find. So that's a subject that has really fit well with trying to educate our military. So I'm sure in your own career as a Navy intelligence officer, you had to think about those issues about what's the proper role of a professional military officer in our democratic society. And space has been a lifelong interest of mine. And as the war on terror has wound down, we focused more on issues with China and Russia as potential peer competitors. Space is really pretty rapidly moved up the agenda for the Defense Department. So I've been increasing the amount of teaching and research I'm doing in that area. And this has really now become an issue of great attention for the country.
And David, let me ask a quick follow-up question on that. A lot of the students that I've taught at, say, Carleton College or prior to that at Metro State University have an interest in that sort of that intersection of studying national mm-hmm. security issues and serving in a national security capacity. You happen to be somebody with a doctorate who teaches in DOD at the Naval War College. What kind of advice would you give to students who are in college today who are maybe in the international relations track or policy or political science track in general? For how they can get into service in the government in that capacity.
It's a tough question because the one reality is so long as the we've had the budget constraints and other things that we've had in government, it isn't necessarily easy.
Very competitive environment, right?
it is. And certainly one avenue is in fact military service. Not only serving in the military, there are a lot of people who, if you look at the civilian employees, the civilian policy analysts at DOD, a lot of them have prior military experience. What I would suggest in general is, probably to get into an interesting government career, they're probably going to need some form of master's degree beyond a bachelor's degree. And there are various programs in international relations. But also, in addition to studying the very theoretical part of political science, I would advise getting some practical managerial skills, practical skill, being able to write a good, concise memo, having mm-hmm. some understanding of how to navigate organizations. I think, we political scientists do a pretty good job of helping people to understand the really big picture, how politics work, what's going on in the world. If you really want to be competitive, I would also try to make sure that you're able to bring, some more practical skills of how are you going to be able to function, in an environment where you're not simply, writing papers about the big questions, but needing to take action, make practical recommendations, develop some talent at doing that.
So turning concepts into actual policy, that's the key.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So for our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1, and we're broadcasting out of Northfield, Minnesota. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Dr. David Burbach, and we're discussing the importance of space to American national security. So David, let's plunge right in and get started on our topic today, space. I think it would be probably wise to start with describing what is in space today so people sort of understand what's on orbit. Can you give our listeners a sense of how many satellites are currently on orbit around the Earth, maybe some of the countries that are the biggest spacefaring nations?
Yeah, today there are just about 5,000 operating satellites orbiting the Earth. And probably, one of the most important things about that number is how rapidly it's growing. 10 years ago, there were about 1,000 operational satellites. Just 5 years ago, 2,000. The number's skyrocketing. It sounds a little crazy, but you can attribute a lot of that to one person, Elon Musk.
Right.
of those 5,000 satellites, approximately 2,000 of them belong to SpaceX for their Starlink communications program. So of that 5,000, about 3,000 are owned by the U.S. government or U.S. commercial entities. Of that 3,000, again, about 2,000 are SpaceX alone. The U.S. military has something like 250 satellites that it operates. And we are way out in the lead because of the growth of the American commercial sector. For other countries, China is the number two country with about 450 satellites. Russia has about 150. Japan, the UK, and India between 75 and 150 each. Other countries that you might expect, like Germany or Canada, also have several dozen satellites. With the growth, not only SpaceX but some of the other new startups that are launching lots of little satellites, the U.S. is just way out in front on total number of satellites in orbit.
Okay. And let's talk a little bit about the kinds of orbits that satellites follow, because that actually is pretty important with regard to their functionality. And I found from teaching my courses at Carleton College, the overview course on the U.S. intelligence community, that my students actually really find this this information pretty fascinating, this concept of orbital mechanics. So maybe we should start with what kind of satellites are on low Earth orbit or LEO orbit?
Sure. Back in high school, I actually used to work at the planetarium in Portland, Oregon. So I can slip back into planetarium mode. Imagine, if you will, that the Earth is the size of a soccer ball, standard soccer ball, about 8 inches across. If soccer is too exotic for you, imagine a basketball. It's just a little bit larger. If the Earth is the size of a soccer ball, that means about 1 inch equals about 1,000 miles. On that scale, the moon is a little smaller than a tennis ball, almost exactly the size of a billiard ball. So if you imagine a soccer ball, most of the satellites that we're talking about are in what we call low Earth orbit, meaning they're pretty close to the Earth. And on that soccer ball scale, that means they're about a quarter of an inch to 1 inch above the surface of that soccer ball. So, really, if you put your finger on the soccer ball, an awful lot of those satellites are, no further off the ball than the thickness of your finger. Just to illustrate that another way, the International Space Station orbits about 400 kilometers above the Earth. Minneapolis to Chicago is 600 kilometers. So if the space station is directly overhead, it's in space, but it's closer to Northfield than Chicago would be. So of those 5,000 satellites, I think about 4,000 of them are in low Earth orbit. And so they're, most satellites are pretty close to the Earth. At that distance, it takes about 90 minutes for them to complete a full circle around the Earth, going about 18,000 miles an hour.
And what kind of satellites specifically are in LEO orbit, typically?
It's a pretty wide range. Where that growth is happening is constellations of communication satellites, basically putting cell towers in orbit so that you'll be able to get high speed wireless data via satellites as well as via local cell towers. More traditionally, that's also the orbit where we operate civilian remote sensing satellites, taking pictures of the Earth in visible or infrared or other types of other spectrum. That's also on the non-civilian side, where most of the spy satellites that are taking pictures of the Earth for military and intelligence purposes. Some weather satellites operate at low levels like that. We can talk in a second about other types of satellites. That's not where GPS operates. That's not where, your DirecTV broadcast satellite operates. But human spaceflight almost always, except for the Apollo missions to the moon, human spaceflight has pretty much all been in that relatively low orbit band around the Earth.
Okay. So why don't we go ahead and talk next about, a geostationary, geosynchronous orbits. You were touching on that just a minute ago. What kind of satellites are located in this orbital area, and where is that orbital plane specifically?
Sure. There's a very special orbit that we call geosynchronous orbit or geostationary orbit. Think back to that soccer ball. I mentioned that, an inch off the surface, satellites are taking about 90 minutes to go all the way around. The moon takes 28 days to go around. And as you move from close to the Earth to farther away from the Earth, orbital periods get longer and longer. Well, if it's 90 minutes close in and 28 days far out, there's a particular distance where it takes exactly 24 hours to go around. And of course, the Earth takes 24 hours to turn. So if you put a satellite at exactly that distance, it moves along with the rotation of the Earth, and so it appears to hover overhead in the same spot. That's a really useful thing because you can point an antenna at that spot, and the antenna doesn't have to move. You know, like, and thus, you know, the DirecTV antennas that you see on people's houses, they're not on, you know, some giant gimbal tracking a high-speed satellite. They just point at the same place. So that's where we put our big communication satellites, TV broadcasts, but also satellites that will transmit telephone calls from one continent to another. So the number of satellites in geosynchronous orbit is relatively small. It's a couple of hundred, but those are some of the biggest, most expensive, most critical, you know, hard to replace satellites, both for commercial use, also military communication satellites up at that altitude. Also some weather satellites, because at that far out, you're able to see the whole disk of Earth at once, so you can get a wide angle picture all at once. Mm-hmm.
And that orbital plane, that's out just plus or minus a degree or two off the equatorial plane. Is that right?
Exactly. I should have clarified that. Yeah, so that if it's directly over the equator, it won't really move north to south very much either. If it's at that distance, you know, going from pole to pole, then it's still moving north-south. So, yeah, over the equator, and that's about 25,000 miles out. By my soccer ball example, it's about 2 feet away. For perspective, you know, the moon is, by that scale, 20 feet away from the soccer ball, so about 10 times farther out from geosynchronous orbit. So going to the moon is really, you know, relative to most, you know, of our satellites, there's nothing out at the lunar distance. He is as close as the moon is relative to Mars or Venus or other planets. All of our space use of space action occurs pretty close into the Earth.
Okay. And finally, so we know we're at 45 degrees mm-hmm. latitude here in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. Cuts almost halfway through, right? And I know that when I was assigned as naval attaché in Helsinki, Finland, Helsinki is actually at roughly 60 degrees north latitude, which is roughly the same as the middle of Hudson Bay in Canada. So the further north you get, let's think Russia, you have to have a way to have these communication satellites that support you. But if you're on geosynchronous orbit, it's kind of hard to reach that high northern plane. So I know that the old Soviet Union developed some capabilities to have communication satellites that would mm-hmm. support their military operations. Can you talk a little bit about those more specialized orbital paths?
Sure. And just to help your listeners visualize that, if you're at the North Pole, something out at the equator is on the horizon. So if you're in northern Siberia trying to talk to a satellite out over the equator, your antenna is pointing down into the trees. You know, it's difficult to work. So what the Soviets came up with, and here to complicate our orbital mechanics a little bit, most satellites move in something close to a circle. The Soviets came up with the idea of having a satellite in a very elliptical orbit, very elongated, and a satellite in that orbit, when it comes down close to the Earth, will move fast, and then as it goes up to apogee, will be moving pretty slowly. So they figured if you have a satellite that's in a highly inclined orbit so that it goes pretty far north and have its apogee up, you know, at that altitude, it will spend half of its orbit in roughly the same spot, not stationary like the geosynchronous satellites, but not moving very fast. And so that's pretty easy for an antenna to track. So if you have an orbit with several of those satellites at any given time, one of them is likely to be in a relatively slow-moving spot, and you can have an antenna follow it. Then as it starts to speed up, you have the antenna move to the next one that's coming into that slow spot. And so Russia still makes use of satellites like that because, again, just the geometry makes the equatorial satellites a little more difficult for them to use.
So I think if I remember correctly, they called that a Molnaya orbit or a lightning orbit?
Exactly.
And they refer to that because when it's at, perigee, closest to the Earth as it's going over the Antarctic continent, it's moving very, very fast. And then as it shoots back up above the northern hemisphere, it sort of slows down in that sort of dwell area above the North Pole, roughly.
That's exactly right.
Okay. So for our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Dr. David Burbach from the U.S. Naval War College, and we're discussing the importance of space to American national security. All right, so continuing on with this discussion of what's up in space, Professor Burbach, let's talk a little bit about the hazards of space travel in the modern era. Can you tell us about the amount of debris that is in orbit today? How much junk is up there, and why is it so dangerous?
Sure. Well, as an oh my gosh number, there are probably several hundred million pieces of debris the size of a BB or larger. Now, space is big, but 100 million is a lot. Yeah. Let me. What am I talking about here? What's actually up in space? Well, as I said, there are several thousand operational satellites. There are probably a couple thousand more defunct satellites. Satellites will gradually lose altitude and re-enter, even several hundred kilometers up. There's still a tiny bit of atmosphere that will very slowly cause drag, slow a satellite down. Up in geosynchronous orbit, that'll take hundreds of years. At the altitude of the space station, they have to give themselves a little boost every few weeks or months, I think, to stay at the same altitude. So there are satellites that are left. Some have reentered. Many are still up there. There are also burned out rocket stages after they put a satellite in orbit. They're left. There are pieces that fall off. Things that astronauts have dropped when they were working on spacewalks and floated away. And old satellites often blow up. Not because we want them to, but if you think about how, they warn you about how the lithium battery in your laptop, if you mistreat it, it can explode. Well, space is a difficult environment. So when a satellite's dead and it's warming up and cooling down over and over again, the battery might explode. There might be leftover propellant that leaks and causes an explosion. So actually a fair number of defunct satellites will break up on their own when something eventually goes wrong. Every now and then, satellites smash into each other and create thousands and thousands of pieces of debris. And there have been, not a lot, but there have been a number of cases of countries testing anti-satellite weapons where they blow something up in space, and that creates a lot of debris. So what does that add up to? We're tracking about 30,000 pieces of debris that are several inches or bigger. And then again, probably hundreds of millions, a millimeter or bigger. Now, why does this matter? If in low Earth orbit, if you're traveling about 18,000 miles an hour, worst case, if you have a head-on collision, that's 36,000 miles an hour, or about 10 times the speed of a rifle bullet. Kinetic energy goes by the square of the velocity, so that's 100 times as much energy as a bullet of the same size hitting. So even something a millimeter is plenty to punch a hole in the thin aluminum skin of a satellite or a space vehicle. Something a few inches in size can destroy a satellite pretty easily. So, every now and then the space shuttle would come back with, little dings and dents where tiny, even a fleck of paint would be enough to damage the tiles on the old space shuttle. Mm. And if the space station were to be hit by, something the size of, if an astronaut threw a wrench overboard and it came back and hit the space station, years later, that could easily punch a big hole in the side of the space station.
Yeah. So what you're talking about is very bad, in other words.
Absolutely. Space is big, but it's not big enough.
So if anybody out there in our listening audience wants to find a way to get unbelievably wealthy, if you can come up with a way to clean up space, you will have solved a major challenge for the entire human race.
I will say on that, the head of Space Force has actually said he would eagerly pay people by the ton to remove debris from space. Like, figure it out. We will write you a big check.
Okay, get out your big magnets. Okay, so now that we understood a little more about orbital mechanics and the challenges of operating in space today, Dr. Burbach, let's dive into the national security ramifications of space operations, and our reliance on space really for a wide range of warfighting capabilities. Let's concentrate on that initially. How important has the Global Positioning System, or GPS, been for the U.S. military for the past quarter century, let's say?
Extremely important. GPS, there was a time when I might have had to explain GPS. Maybe I still need to explain it, because we now are so used to it, nobody even knows that it's there. Your younger listeners will not remember, but there used to be a time when you didn't know where you were unless you could look at a map and figure it out.
A paper map.
I know it's a, you know, I still have my old, you know, paper topographic atlases. So, you know, when the big one hits, you know, I'll still be able to find my way around maybe. But GPS is a constellation of several dozen satellites orbiting almost out to geosynchronous. They're not quite that far out, but a constellation of satellites that broadcast signals that let a user pick them up and triangulate to extreme precision where they are. That's huge because for military operations, knowing where you are, not just like, you know, which town am I near, but where you are to the level of a few feet one way or the other allows you to do things like lob a cruise missile and have it go directly, you know, choose which floor of a building you want it to come into when it reaches its target and attacks something. Or it allows you to operate in all weather. I mean, the, you know, if used to be, you know, before we had GPS, if you were out at sea on a ship and it was severely fogged in, you know, you could be really good with a sextant navigating by the stars, but if you can't see the stars, you've got a problem. So, you know, you have a compass and you kind of figure out, well, we've been headed this direction at 10 knots for how long? I guess we must be about here. GPS means no matter what the weather is, you know where you are to an accuracy of a couple of feet. We even are now able to use it so accurately that airplanes can land using GPS, even mm-hmm. without radio beacons on the ground. So this has been tremendously enabling, not only for all of us to be able to navigate with our cars, to, you know, again, have our commercial airliners now, you know, can be much more accurate, land in worse weather. And the military, which likes to do things like be able to operate at night, operate in bad weather, target weapons with extreme precision, it's been really revolutionary for both the civilian economy and for military operations.
And what other ways is space important to the U.S. military or for U.S. national security in general?
Sure. I'll suggest to your readers if they want to see kind of a short, you know, cool little video, Space Force, I think actually it was still the Air Force that put it out before Space Force. If you Google Space Force, A Day Without Space, there's about a 3 or 4 minute video, you know, sort of imagining all the awful things that happened, you know, to some poor team trying to deal with a terrorist somewhere if they lose their space capabilities. But we use it for a lot. In addition to GPS, space is very important for military communications. If you're operating somewhere, you know, out overseas, you won't have a cell phone network you can use. So satellite phones, satellite communications, satellite links connecting drones back to, we control most of our unmanned drones from a base in Nevada, just outside Las Vegas, using satellite links.
Creech Air Force Base, right?
Exactly. So very important for communications, defense weather satellites. But probably the single most important historically has been we use space to spy on people.
Right.
We use space to see what's going on. It was only 2 years after Sputnik that the U.S. first launched its first spy satellite because we had no idea. How many nuclear missiles did the Soviets have? Where were their nuclear missiles? What kind of missiles did they have? And our spy satellites told us pretty quickly, hey, they actually have a lot fewer missiles than we feared. That was a good thing. You know, they provide the ability to know, are they getting ready to launch their missiles? We also have satellites specifically that watch for missile launches. They can detect the flame, you know, the plume from a rocket taking off. So space has been absolutely essential to be able to know what adversaries are up to, especially back in the day, you know, when the Soviets were a very close society. I mean, we didn't even know where cities were located, and, you know, they hid their maps so much. With space, we know what everybody is up to all around the world.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the dangers to the satellites that exist. You talked about the ones that are up there sort of out of foolishness or bad engineering or just the way things go, the debris that's up there. But what about the intentional targeting of satellites? The U.S. has tested anti-satellite capabilities, ASAT mm-hmm. capabilities, missiles specifically. And we know that both China and Russia have done the same, Russia more recently. What's most concerning to you about ASAT capabilities becoming more mainstream and potentially being used really immediately should a conventional war develop between major powers because of the importance of space to military operations?
Sure. I'd say two things, and you've touched on both of them a bit. One is simply the, as we've talked about, the debris creation, where that one, your listeners may have seen in the news, the Russians conducted an ASAT test in November. That alone created, of those 30,000 pieces of debris I mentioned that we can track, that test alone created more than 1,000 new ones. So you don't have to destroy many satellites to really start increasing the amount of debris in space. So, you know, even on it, and of course, it doesn't matter whether it's in wartime or a test, you know, even if people start doing significant, you know, a large number of anti-satellite tests, that could make space really difficult. And so if we have sort of an, you know, in the bad old days of the Cold War, there were years where we did nuclear tests just to sort of show, well, you did three nuclear tests, so we'll do three nuclear right. tests. Yeah. If we did that with satellites, space would get pretty messy pretty quickly. The other one that you hinted at there is we often worry that space is what political scientists call offense dominant, mm-hmm. Meaning whoever strikes first, whoever goes on the offense probably gets an advantage. It's really difficult to defend a satellite from an incoming anti-satellite weapon. You can't put armor on it like a tank because it would be too heavy to launch.
Right.
So there's a real concern that there are strong first strike incentives. And that can lead to instability, where if I fear that things are about to go bad, I want to, you know, I may think it's worth preempting and taking out your space capabilities before you have the ability to do that to me. So if space is really seen as highly weaponized, as a theater to take the war into, it could be one where countries feel a need to go for to be very quick on that trigger finger. You know, when you're talking about war between nuclear armed peer competitors, that's a worrying thing.
I'm going to follow up on that in a little bit, but one of the things I think we should talk about, you've mentioned a little bit, is sort of a rather sizable development in American national security interests, especially with regard to space, and that's a creation of what is still a relatively new U.S. Space Force. So first, what is the U.S. Space Force? Can you explain that to our listeners?
Sure. The Space Force, it's both an extremely important and new development, but in other ways, it may be a little less than it appears. And the way that it's new is we organize our military into distinct services. You know, the Army, Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps. And creating a new one is a really unusual thing. The Air Force was created in 1947. The other three have been around, to a rough approximation, since the beginning of the country. So to create a whole new service, meaning that the people serving in Space Force, you know, they're not an Air Force or an Army. You know, they are Space Force officers now, with their own uniforms. You know, they'll eventually have, you know, their own fight song and their own medals. And, anyone who's been in the military will know there's a lot of emphasis put on, you know, things like uniforms and challenge coins and, you know, heraldry. I mean, that's, you know, that's the relatively silly and easy stuff. So this is what the biggest change in U.S. defense organization really since the creation of the Air Force. Now, what is not so new about it is mostly Space Force takes what we already had for space, mostly from the Air Force, and puts it into this new service. So it is not the case that 3 years ago we didn't have anything in space, and now we have like space battle cruisers run. Now, for most people in Space Force, the vast majority were Air Force. So mm-hmm. an Air Force officer who used to operate GPS or work at the Cape Canaveral launch base or, you know, did surveillance to see what others were up to in space, mostly they took off their Air Force uniform and have now put on Space Force uniforms. The intent of the change, though, is to create more focus on space. And John, as a former Navy officer, you will be familiar with, you know, services tend to have communities that dominate.
Yep.
As an intel officer, you probably did not feel like you were in the dominant community.
Definitely not.
You know, absolutely not. And the Air Force was seen as – it was, you know, run by fighter pilots. You know, for the last several decades, the real dominant focus of the Air Force has been on tactical aviation. Mm-hmm. In the early Cold War, bomber pilots. not so much space. Not that they, you know, didn't care, but the sense that developed was that as China and Russia were investing in space, that we didn't have enough focus, and that creating a separate service would really create a core institution, core of people in the U.S. for whom everything they did every day was space, and that they would be more focused in developing new technology and operating it, spending money wisely. So that was the bureaucratic impetus for this creation.
And what kind of capability is Space Force bringing to bear in support of American national security? And in other words, you know, can you talk a little bit, maybe not super detailed, but just sort of in general, how is Space Force organized and what missions do they perform or will they perform? And my understanding is that much like the Marine Corps is in the Department of the Navy, U.S. Space Force is in the Department of the Air Force. Is that correct too?
That's correct. Let me start on that part first. Yeah, this was an area of debate. Should Space Force have its own, not only in a separate service, but its own department with its own civilian secretary of the Space Force? The decision was to go more like the Marine Corps. And in fact, the Air Force will provide a lot of the support functions. Space Force will not have its own medical corps. It will not have its own JAGS, the military lawyers. A lot of those support, in order to keep the Space Force, you know, rather than duplicate. The decision was they'd rely on the Air Force for a lot of those support capabilities. There's not going to be anytime soon a Space Force War College. if they open one of those, whether they open it in Alabama or Colorado may matter a little bit for whether I'd want to go. I'm kind of a dry weather and mountains guy more than I am warm and humid. So we'll see about that. In terms of the mission areas for Space Force, there are a couple of things they do. One is what they call space domain awareness, which means knowing what is in space and what is it up to. They have a lot of tracking radars. They're responsible for knowing what's in orbit and not just what's in orbit, but figuring out what are the capabilities of other countries' satellites? What are they trying to do with them? They also operate and provide space support to the rest of the services. So Space Force runs the GPS satellites, the communication satellites. The decision that was eventually made was they don't actually operate the reconnaissance satellites. There's an organization in the intelligence community called the National Reconnaissance Office. They operate the spy satellites, and those were not given to Space Force. And then Space Force is in charge of defending satellites from adversary attacks and potentially engaging in offensive counter-space operations. That is, if we want to damage or disable adversary satellites. We do have a few ways of doing that we've acknowledged. They've shown they have a big radar, big dish on a truck that they have acknowledged can be used to jam enemy communication satellites. Certainly not on any kind of open basis, and I think this is correct. We actually don't have any anti-satellite weapons that we have in the inventory ready to go. We have tested them. We thought about developing them in the 1980s. I have no doubt we have the technology to do that, and some of our ballistic missile defense missiles could be used against some satellites. Space Force does not have anti-satellite weapons per se, and especially their recruiting commercials may give you a different impression, but Space Force does not have astronauts. It does not have battle cruisers, zipping around in space, firing lasers at enemy satellites. In fact, Space Force doesn't really have any pilots. They probably have a few. I'm sure they have some aircraft they use to move their VIPs around. But it's really technical people, doing a lot, operating satellites, developing new technologies, thinking about defensive and offensive operations with robotic systems, anti-satellite weapons. But Space Force does not have spaceships or astronauts.
So their recruiting is probably going to be very heavy on the technical side, engineers, physicists, that kind of thing.
I would think so. And in fact, to their credit, they're really looking at some ways to be more flexible with military careers. They recognize they need to attract a very technical workforce. They're going to want them to have, you know, stay for the long term, and that a lot of the knowledge they need is on the outside. So they're still figuring out how to work this, but they're looking to be able to give a lot more flexibility to their officers to, say, go get graduate degrees while still in service, to be able to go spend a year or two in private industry and mm-hmm. come back, you know. So, like, for example, maybe you go spend a year working for SpaceX right. or, you know, an IT company, and come back to the force with a better understanding of what the commercial capabilities are. So they recognize that, you know, and the, you know, I hope, you know, you, John, you will know that the military likes to squish everything into identical looking boxes.
Oh, yeah.
So hopefully they'll be able to continue with this. But the Space Force leadership, you know, there are a lot of complaints about inflexibilities in traditional military careers. Space Force, again, to their credit, is picking up on that and is looking to, I think, try some innovative personnel system approaches to be able to attract and keep the kind of technical people they need.
That's good. That's good. Hey, so for our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Dr. David Burbach from the U.S. Naval War College, and we're discussing the importance of space to American national security. So, David, let's pull back out a bit on the nexus between space and American national security. Can you talk a little bit about the current treaties that exist that apply to space? What are they, and how do they impact space?
Yeah, space is not entirely the ungoverned Wild West. We actually do have some international law governing space. Some of it looks a little bit like law for the high seas, and actually the real model that people thought of was how we manage Antarctica. Mm-hmm. Back in the late 1960s, all the major countries agreed to something called the Outer Space Treaty, with some fundamental principles. Most importantly, they agreed nobody can claim territory in space. You know, you can plant a flag on the moon to say we were here, take a good picture, but no country, and all the major spacefaring countries have agreed to this, you can't claim territory, you can't say this orbital zone belongs to us and you can't use it. All of space is open to the free and peaceful use of all countries. The treaty also said you can't put nuclear weapons in space. And it said you cannot put any military equipment or conduct any military activities on the moon or other solid bodies. And in general, that, you know, language that is ambitious and maybe a bit vague, but that space should be used strictly for the peaceful benefit of all humankind. So we all have agreed nobody can go to the moon and say this crater belongs to us, stay out. Notably, the treaty does not ban weapons in space. It certainly suggests, hey, we'd really, you know, we all think space ought to be pretty peaceful, but as the major countries have interpreted it, if you were to put, you know, an anti-satellite weapon in orbit and it just sits there, that the U.S., the Soviets, the Chinese all agree that counts as a peaceful use of space until you actually fire it at an adversary. So beyond that, it is relatively vague, and there are more specific rules too. For example, everybody agrees that if a foreign astronaut crash lands in your territory, you're supposed to help them out. One thing that's relevant with the growth in the commercial sector, major countries have all agreed anything that's launched from your country or by an organization based in your country, it's your responsibility. So if SpaceX, you know, if Jeff Bezos, if they launch something, the United States government is ultimately on the hook if that were to crash and cause damage somewhere else. And so that's one reason we have a regulatory system to make sure, you know, that they have insurance and that we think their rockets aren't going to blow up. But ultimately, it says countries are on the hook for whatever their citizens do in space.
So how do you see things playing out as more advanced technologies continue to be developed, especially in the reconnaissance and the warfare area, new defense-related technologies, maneuverable reentry vehicles, hypersonic delivery capabilities, directed energy weapons, those kind of things, mm-hmm. Space planes. How do you see that impacting space?
Boy, a lot to talk about there. And one place that I'll start is just to mention, we often talk about there being a dual-use dilemma for space, mm-hmm. meaning that almost any technology that's useful for civilian applications has direct military applications. And probably the best illustration of that is it is, you know, when SpaceX launches a capsule to the space station or puts a Space Force satellite in orbit, they're using exactly the same rocket, their Falcon 9. If somebody's building a new rocket, is it going to be for a space hotel or are they going to launch, you know, a laser battle platform? Who knows? Likewise, you know, an area of technology that's growing rapidly on the civilian side is interest in robotic satellites that can rendezvous and then refuel or repair commercial satellites mm-hmm. To get more use out of them. Well, the dual use problem there is if I can rendezvous with your satellite and refuel it, I could, instead of having a refueling probe, I can have like a big pair of garden shears and I could rendezvous and cut your solar panel off or a can of spray paint and I paint over the lens on your spy camera. This is a real issue where the Chinese and the Russians point the Space Force, I guess, now has a small space plane. The X-37 looks like a miniature space shuttle. They point at that and say, well, we think this has military use to, you know, maybe you're going to grab one of our satellites. We say it's just a, you know, to take technology up in space and test it out. We point to, you know, I have seen us cite the robotic arm on the new Chinese space station, like the space shuttle had an arm or our space station has one, and say, ah, well, that's technology that could be used to grab and disable a satellite. Well, you know, so everybody gets very suspicious of new technology because anything probably has a military use. So what are some of the things to look for? Actually, one that I'll point to beyond some of those technologies is simply the growth of the commercial sector, where there's a explosion in surveillance capabilities from the private sector. Lots mm-hmm. of, you know, when you see satellite photos of some, like if you remember the that ship that got stuck in the Suez Canal, we all, right. you know, we had all had detailed satellite photos, you know, the next day. Nothing happens on Earth now that commercial companies, including non-American commercial companies, right. they can provide you detailed imagery, radar scan. So one thing we have to think about on our military side is everything we do is being watched and watched by people who won't necessarily stop watching if we ask them to.
Right.
and that's a different way of having to operate. It also works well for us because I frankly think we're more used to that than some of our adversaries. We're just a more open society. In terms of some of the other technologies, I'm not sure space, you know, other I'm not sure space planes actually change all that much. It does, and I think we're getting some use being able to it's convenient to be able to take stuff up and test it and bring it back. But I'm not sure that I would point to that as a big change. You mentioned hypersonics and maneuvering reentry vehicles for missiles. In some ways, those aren't necessarily – like technically, we wouldn't consider those space weapons because they don't go into orbit and hang out in space. The Outer Space Treaty – because nobody wanted to give up their long-range nuclear missiles, we and the Russians and the Soviets and the China, you know, everybody agrees that a ballistic missile going through space is not actually in space. It's a bit of, you know, legal, you know, maneuvering, but, you know, nobody wanted to give up their missiles. So technically, we don't count those as space weapons, but what they do create is, you know, making it more difficult for the U.S. to possibly intercept and defend the country from incoming adversary missiles. I've been pretty skeptical of our missile defense capabilities. I mean, we've for short range missiles, like we just saw in the Persian Gulf, we've got some real capability. For say modern Russian ICBMs, I would not want to count on all the nuclear bombs being intercepted. You know, I'd rather avoid them coming at us in the first place. What both the Russians and the Chinese are doing is exploring these, you know, new technologies that'll make it even more difficult to track and intercept. So I think the big takeaway is if you thought missile defense was going to get us out of the risk of nuclear retaliation, I'm skeptical that we're actually going to get there.
Yeah, and I don't think the like ground-based missile defense is really designed for a major nuclear exchange between the U.S. and Russia or the U.S. and China. It's really more about, you know, defending against small numbers of missiles launched from, say, North Korea or Iran or something like that.
Exactly.
So you mentioned Russia and China and impacts to our deterrence strategies. What kind of capabilities are the Russians and Chinese working on specifically that kind of undermine our traditional thoughts about deterrence?
Well, look, a couple of things. And, you know, the one thing that's very clear is both Russia and this goes beyond just space. They are both absolutely determined, as I would be if I were one of their strategists, that under any circumstance, they want to be able to retaliate against the United States with nuclear weapons if they want to be in a position where they think the U.S. can never get away with a disarming first strike on them. And that motivates a couple of things. I mean, Putin has talked about what sound like some crazy new weapons, like an intercontinental underwater torpedo with a 100 megaton bomb, like it, you know, quietly goes across the Atlantic, you know, and then goes up to New York Harbor and sets off a giant nuke, or nuclear powered ramjets. Like imagine, you know, something the size of a nuclear bomb, of a bomber, but it's got a nuclear reactor as it flies through the atmosphere, flying at Mach 3 intercontinental range. We actually thought about building that in the 1960s ourselves and decided, you know, that's like, does anybody even want to be around when you hit go on the test of that thing? Yeah. Well, the Russians actually, they tried testing something like that about 2 years ago, and apparently the reactor blew up when they fished it out of the water, and it actually injured, or I forget if it injured or maybe even killed a couple of their engineers. But the Russians, I think they're signaling, you know, we are going to do whatever it takes to be sure that we have a technology that we think will get around. You know, you won't be able to preemptively destroy our missiles. You won't be able to shoot them down. And that's similar. You know, the Chinese too recently tested what we call a FOBS, FOBS, fractional orbital bombardment system, which simply means that instead of going, you know, the short way like a cannonball from China, I used to be sort of across the Pacific to the U.S., they tested going the long way around, putting something in a partial orbit and then deorbiting it to come down, which if you imagine in wartime would mean it would come up over South America from the south where we don't have warning radars, we don't have missile defenses. Again, I have not been somebody who thought, well, I'm not worried about all these nuclear weapons because we have defenses, because we really don't have much in the way of defenses. But what I think they've both signaled is, even if you were to rapidly expand your traditional missile defenses, we're ready with other technologies that would neutralize you. So don't, you know, let's not get in a defensive race. You're not going to be able, you know, nobody's going to get out of what, you know, what we've long called mutually assured destruction.
Yeah. So I think that's really the calculation that's being made in both Moscow and Beijing, is that there's this desire to maintain that mutual assured destruction deterrence factor. And they see us advancing, we see them advancing, both Russia and China. So these new technologies could be destabilizing if we're not in constant communication with each other, right? The value of diplomacy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And for a space angle there, you know, a real worry that both Russia and China would have is they particularly fear the U.S. might try and take away their space warning capabilities. Mm-hmm. If the Russians lost their missile warning satellites because we disabled or destroyed them, so they didn't know American missiles were coming until they were much closer and showed up on radar. You know, they worry about U.S. intentions. Now we have, you know, of course, they're the ones who have done ASAT tests more recently,
right?
You know, and we might, you know, we can reasonably worry about the same thing. So in the Cold War, we actually, you know, we sort of recognize that going after, you know, on the one hand, if you attacked a missile warning satellite before you were really about to push the big red button, you might trigger a war you didn't want. On the other hand, if you really were going to push the big red button, it would be useful to take out those satellites. And that's a basic dilemma that we faced all through the Cold War, you know, and still if we worry about that.
Yep. So, Dr. David Burbach, we're closing in on the end of our time this morning, unfortunately. This has been fascinating. I'm going to open up the floor to you. What else should listeners know about the nexus of space and American national security interest? Anything we haven't covered today that you feel is really important?
You know, a couple of areas that I would suggest we need to think about. One relates to the debris problem, where in general, we need to worry about, people are calling it space sustainability or more narrowly space traffic management, that not only anti-satellites, but as these constellations of satellites grow, SpaceX plans, you know, they've talked about putting up as many as 100,000 satellites of their own. And there are other companies, too, that want similar size. So we're getting to a point where we're going to need some international regulation. The Outer Space Treaty, all it says is don't harmfully interfere with other countries. We're going to need to be specific about what does that mean. And maybe we need something, you know, more like how we have global rules on air traffic management and air traffic control. And I would love to see agreements against anti-satellite testing, but we need to recognize that at least low Earth orbit is smaller than you would think, and we're going to need international management. The other area, a little more out there, but not as much as you might think, is we're going to need to think about how to share space resources with other countries. Like, nobody can claim territory on the moon, but we also do agree, if you go to the moon and pick up a rock and bring it back to the Earth, can you go on eBay and sell that for presumably a lot of money, at some point? Or what's the law on, if somebody goes to the moon and picks up the flag from the Apollo 11 lander and brings that back and wants to put it in a museum. Yeah. Now, I don't think any country would that would make us really angry, I would think. Yeah. But we don't have good rules on how to manage and share space resources if we and the Chinese both want to, study the ice in some dark lunar crater. How do we manage it if there's, if we're both there and we're going to get in each other's way? How do we manage that? And we are actually, NASA and the U.S. State Department have been, have been trying to do more diplomacy on that, and that's a good thing. But, it's not as far out as you might think that we'll have to worry about that.
Yeah, I agree. And just for my own knowledge, it's always been my impression that the Vice President of the United States generally has been the point person in the U.S. government for leading space policy. Is that still roughly true?
It varies. That has often been the case. Some presidents have not really followed that model. Joe Biden has continued having a VP-led National Space Council, so that, I don't get the sense that Vice President Harris is as space interested as VP Pence was. I mean, he and a lot of it comes down to the personality of the VP. And Pence, sure. Also Dan Quayle back in the H.W. Bush administration were actually pretty, really took that role and ran with it. Okay. We'll see what VP Harris does.
Yeah. So, Dr. David Burbach, thank you so much for taking time from your busy schedule to educate us on space and American national security interests. Is there anything you're currently researching related to this topic?
Yeah, actually, pulling together my interests in civil-military relations and space, I'm looking into Space Force. On the one hand, I'm trying to understand a little more about the politics and the bureaucratics of how we got it. Because in 2016, when a few members of Congress raised the idea, nobody thought it was going to happen. So how exactly did we get there? And that's partly, of value for the officers I teach to help them understand kind of the sausage making in D.C. It's a good example of, you come up with a good idea, how does it actually get enacted? And also, what should Space Force be doing? Should it have a more narrow military role, or should it be like the Army in the U.S. West in the 1800s, doing everything from exploring to, the building the equivalent of trading posts in space? There are some people who see a really expansive role. I probably lean more narrow, but I think this is a good time to think about what its long-term role ought to be.
And the last question I have for you is, any publications out there that you would point to for our listeners to go to if they want to learn more?
Yeah, a couple. One is for more specifically on space security and sustainability, I would recommend looking at two think tanks, the Secure World Foundation or CSIS, Center for Strategic and International Studies. Yeah. Both have put out annual reports meant to be digestible to non-specialists on space capabilities. I've also got on the Naval War College YouTube channel, I've actually got a lecture on space and national security that goes into more detail on some of the issues that we've touched on. That's freely available to anyone who wants to find it.
Great. Well, Professor David Burbach, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me, John. Have a good day.
And that closes this week's edition of National Security This Week. We're on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today. I look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Before we sign off, I'd just like to remind our readers, or our listeners, excuse me, that 2 weeks ago, January 11th, my co-author David Bruns and I launched our fifth novel together, Command and Control. We now have over 100 reviews on Amazon for that novel, and our next book in the trilogy, Counter-Strike, launches on February 8th, so it's coming soon to a bookstore near you. Thank you for listening to National Security This Week here on KYMN Radio. Have a great finish to your week, everyone. Take care.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly show looking into issues of American national security with the host, John Olson. Listen every Wednesday at 9 a.m. for National Security This Week.